Wow, that might be the quickest we've ever gone through. Hopefully I can get my story. Maybe we might be ending early tonight. My name's John Blake. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
I'll start out by just telling you what it was like at the end for me. So I went to my favorite bar, right, and I walked in the door, and like a typical alcoholic at the time, you know, I had done the best I could to polish off the liquor I had at the house. And I went walking into the door of the bar, and the bartender says, "I can tell already you're drunk, man. Get out of here." So I stumbled out the door and went down a little ways, and I opened up the next door and went walking in, and he said, "Look, I already told you, get out of here. We're not serving you tonight." And I stumbled out the door and went down a little ways and stumbled in the door, and I opened up the door, and he said, "If you come in here again, I'm going to call the cops." And that's about how it was for me at the end of my drinking. So I'm going to start out tonight with, I should tell you this. My sobriety date is June 7th, 2006. And my home group is Shoulder to Shoulder in Yorktown. And my sponsor's up there. I have two sponsors, but I'll get into that later. I'm going to start out tonight with a poem. This is called "The Man in the Glass." When you get what you want and struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father, your mother, your wife who judgment upon you must pass. The fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. Some people may think you're a straight shooting chum, call you a wonderful guy. But the man in the glass is you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest. For he's with you clear up into the end. And you pass your most dangerous and difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. You may fool the whole world down the pathway of life and get pats on the back as you pass. But your final reward will be heartache and tears if you cheated the man in the glass. That's what AA has taught me, to stop cheating the man in the glass. So I start back to my earliest memory, and I'm the youngest of eight boys, Irish Catholic. We were kind of talking about it a little bit before. So all my brothers, we live right outside of Philadelphia, a little suburb outside of Philadelphia, and we had this big lot in the backyard, and my brothers all before me, they used to set up the tent in the backyard, and they would go back there and party with their friends and drink and everything. So when I became of age that we could stay out there in the yard, we did the same thing. We got my friends and we went down to hang out near the local bar, and we asked some guy to buy us a case of Genesee cream ale, and we got brought it back, sat down. This is how I know the difference between what I am as an alcoholic and what my friends are who are non-alcoholic. I've talked to my friends since I've gotten sober and asked them, "Do you remember that night, that first night that we went drinking?" And the guy said, "Like, we did that for about 4 or 5 years once, you know, when we were teenagers. I don't remember the first night. I can picture that first night. And we had that case of beer sitting outside the tent. And we drank some of those beers, maybe a little less than half of that case. And those guys all went, "Well, it's getting late. I'm getting tired. I'm starting to feel the effects of alcohol. I'm going to go to sleep." And I'm looking down at this case of beer saying, "Go to sleep? Can't go to sleep. We still got all this beer to drink, man. What do you mean, go to sleep?" So that's how I kind of knew I was different from everybody else. It went along like that all through my teenage years, and coming up in those times, we were smoking other stuff and we were doing other things and everything, but alcohol was always the key for me. You know, if there wasn't alcohol involved, then I wasn't going to be part of the party, or I didn't go to hang out, or, you know, I didn't get the same effect from those other substances that I got from alcohol. I got that comfort and ease that I wanted from alcohol. So at about 19 years old, 18 and 19 years old, because I was just graduating high school, my mother had remarried to my stepdad, who was my mother and father's best friend while they were growing up. My father passed away, my stepfather's wife passed away, and it just seemed like a natural fit, I guess, for them to get married. He had retired, and he bought a house down in Kissimmee, Florida. And I had just turned 19, or just getting out of high school, didn't have any hope for any kind of future or anything else. My mother was not going to leave me up in New Jersey with my brothers because she knew I probably wouldn't have made it through the year if she'd have left me up there. And he was not about to take me down to Kissimmee and ruin his retirement. You know, he just didn't want to have anything to do with that. So he kept plugging me about going into the Navy and how great it was for his brother was in the Navy during the war and how great it was for his brother, hot meal all the time and a shower and everything else. So finally, I just figured the only way I was going to get away from any of them, and I didn't want to go down there to Florida and be stuck in a situation like that. So I finally decided to go in the Navy. And man, they can teach you how to drink in the Navy. And it didn't take long. I went through boot camp, and back then boot camp was in a couple of different places, but I went to one out in San Diego, and I got put on a ship out there in San Diego, and it was just off to the races after that. It was on the USS Constellation, and we went overseas, and I just kept getting in trouble for drinking, and back then they'd slap you on the wrist and it, you know, send you back to work, and there was a lot of times where guys were covering for me and all that stuff, and that rocked along for a while until I just got in so much trouble that I was about to get kicked out of the Navy. And it was at that point that I was in a holding facility over there in San Diego. And at the holding facility, you had to go to AA meetings on Sunday night. So you had your freedom. You could still go out and everything. You could still, you know, go out in town and do everything else. So you could still go out and party and go out and drink and all that stuff. And that's what we were doing. And then on Sunday, you knew you couldn't get too drunk early on Sunday because you had to go to the AA meeting Sunday night. You know, you don't want to go to the AA meeting too drunk. And I can remember sitting there at that AA meeting, and there was an old timer there, and he had the long white beard, and he had a coffee stain on his big book and everything. And I was sitting over in the corner, kind of passing out and snoring a little bit. And a guy nudged me when I started falling asleep, and I woke up, and that old timer looked over and he said, "Hey, man, don't wake that guy up. If he don't want what I have, he's not going to get it. And just leave him alone." And being a good alcoholic, that kind of pissed me off. You know? And I thought, what do you mean? What are you talking about? What do you mean I can't get with what you're... And there was already a couple guys that were going there to the meeting that were in the facility that I was in that had already gotten sober. And so we started going to a meeting there on the base in San Diego. And it was every day at lunchtime, Monday through Friday, we started going over there. And for the first 30 days, this was back in the days with the Navy before they started doing random urinalysis tests, because for that first 30 days, I was on a marijuana maintenance program. So that was a very humbling experience to have to stand up in front of everybody, because they knew. It was a small group, you know, like what you have here. And they knew when you had 30 days. And I don't even think I raised my hand for 30 days. They just said, "Come get a 30-day chip." And I had to stand up and say, I haven't been sober, you know. And a guy reached out to me right then and there and kind of took me under his wing. And things went along really good while I was out there in San Diego. That last year that I was in San Diego, that the ship was there, the ship I was on, the Constellation, it came around South America and went over into Philadelphia. And when I met Art, we had about a year before the ship left. In that year, I had seen so much of San Diego that I had not seen the past 3 years that I was there. You know, I was just hanging out in the bars all the time getting drunk and never seen any of the city. You know, and on the ship that I was on, when we were going out to sea, we went to Australia and the Philippines and all kinds of other places. And inside those bars is no different than inside the bars right here in Suffolk. You know? And it was just amazing that first year. So the ship, like I said, went back around to Philadelphia, and I went around there, and I kind of plugged in. I was working, doing some step work with Art, and we went through a four-step, and I never got to a fifth step, but I got over into Philadelphia and back into my hometown, and I knew it said in the book, you know, if you don't do the fifth step, you might go get drunk again. So I pulled some guy that was on the ship who was in the program, and I did a fifth step with him. It wasn't honest, and it wasn't thorough, and it wasn't, you know, what it was supposed to be. But I thought it was a fifth step. And I ended up getting out of the Navy while I was there, because I thought I knew better trying to manage my life. I thought I knew how to work things and everything. And started looking for little jobs, going to school here and there, and doing things, kind of going to AA, kind of not, you know, kind of doing this and doing that, and and I wasn't really plugged into the program. And then I met a girl, and you know, and we decided we were going to have a family. And so instead of going to 5 or 6 or 7 meetings a week, I started cutting it down, cutting it down, and cutting it down. And then finally, we had bought a house. We had 2 small children. They're 18 months apart, and the oldest one is only about 4 years old. And she's on my back about going to this one meeting a week on Sunday nights. And you know, so I'm thinking, well, good husband, a good father, I don't need to go to AA. I was 21 when I got sober the first time. I thought, I probably wasn't even an alcoholic. You know, I was just going through a bad patch in my life. And so that went along for a while and started to get that unmanageability coming back because I wasn't plugged into the program. We went down to the Jersey Shore. My mother had rented a house down there at Jersey Shore for a month. And I was down there, and a couple of my brothers were down there. And they were all, you know, drinking some beers and sitting on the porch and laughing and having a good time and everything. And in my head, it's going around thinking, surely I could do that. You know what I mean? I didn't have the big book, like I said. I wasn't going to meetings. I didn't have sponsors. But I knew something like this was in my head. We do not like to pronounce any individual an alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take you long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. So, having this alcoholic thinking and knowing how I am, I decide that day I'm going to drink 2 beers. Now, do I go to the refrigerator and come out with a beer and toast with my brothers and, you know, and sit and have a jovial time? No. I wait till everybody goes to bed and I sneak into the kitchen and I drink those 2 beers with nobody knowing about it. And then I go to bed and I wake up the next morning and I don't have that craving for alcohol. And I go, see, I wasn't an alcoholic. I knew I could handle it. I knew that was just a phase I was going through at that time. So, go through a couple other jobs here and there, and we ended up selling the house we were in and going and buying another smaller house that we were in. And by this time, I'm ruining these jobs because of my drinking, because of how, and it's not so much that I'm showing up drunk, but it's because of my combative attitude, because I'm right and you're wrong. Right, that's what's driving me out of these jobs. And then of course, as soon as I get fired from a job, that's a reason to go get drunk. I'm a cook by trade, so at home I'm making dinner for the family and everything, and I think, well, a glass of wine at dinner, it can't hurt. You know what I mean? We'll have a glass of wine. My wife and I will have a glass of wine. And then of course the bottle of wine's open, so I'm thinking, well, the bottle of wine's open, so, you know, we'll drink the bottle of wine. And there's no we'll drink the bottle of wine. She might have had a glass out of that bottle, and I'm drinking the whole entire thing. And that leads to, well, a couple of cocktails before dinner. So things are going along like that for a little while, and 9/11 happens, and I'm in the Navy Reserves at the time, and she's my... It's my ex-wife now. She's having some health problems at the time, and they're looking for voluntary recalls in the Navy. I can't keep a job in the civilian world. And it comes into my head and say, well, I can't get fired from the Navy. I can't get fired from that job. And I got benefits, and yeah. But I don't sell her the thing that I can't get fired. I sell her, you know, we'll get benefits for you, and we'll get benefits for the kids, and we'll get, you know, I'm going to get all this stuff for you to have, you know what I mean? I'm going to provide like I'm supposed to provide. And I guess something came over me at the time, because when I left New Jersey and we went down to Corpus Christi, Texas, I probably stayed sober for about 30 days, because I wanted to leave that old person behind, right? New places, new things, new faces. And again, I went through that struggle. I remember being in Galveston, Texas, and all the guys I was with, they're all my shipmates, they're all out. Excuse me. They're all out and they're having a beer and they're laughing and having a good time. And I'm fighting it. Like, I don't want to drink. I made it three blocks before I bought a beer. And I didn't even get that beer up to my lips, man. I cracked that thing open and heard that, you know, and that was it. That was the ease and comfort that I needed right there. I knew I was about to get it. The only saving grace for being down there in Corpus was I was on a ship. And I was on a mine hunter, and we'd have to go out to sea for about 14 to 20 days. So every once a month or every other month, we would go out to sea for 14 to 20 days. And I'd get 14 to 20 days of sobering up. You know, and that was a saving grace for me at that time. So from there, I left and I got orders up to Fort Worth, Texas. And I got up to Fort Worth, and it was off to the races after that, man. When I moved up there, I bought a 71 Volkswagen Beetle. And if you ever driven a car like that, it's manual steering. So it's hard to turn, and it's kind of hard to maneuver. So you got to kind of grip onto that steering wheel. Until you hit about 55 miles an hour, you get enough wind up underneath that it kind of picks it up, and it makes it a little easier to steer. And I can remember driving home and gripping that steering wheel and just praying, don't drink tonight. Don't drink tonight. Don't drink tonight. And I couldn't get in the house fast enough. I had one of those dollar store tumblers, you know, and I would fill that thing with ice. I would already be in the freezer from the night before, but I would fill it up with ice again, and I had a half a gallon of rum. And still to this day, nobody can explain to me why they put that darn little plastic thing in those big jugs, because it just stops the liquor from coming out any faster. So anytime you buy a half gallon, that would be the first thing I do is pull that thing out and get rid of it so I could get that booze into that cup as quick as I could, right? And I heard a guy one time sharing from the podium, and I really could relate to it. I could remember begging not to drink, begging myself, don't drink tonight. And I would get in that house, just like I was talking about with that beer, and I'd get that cup and I'd start pouring it into the cup and get it up to my lips and in my mouth and just have that feeling. Booze hasn't been into my bloodstream yet. It hasn't gone anywhere, right? It's touched my lips and it's in my mouth, and I get that, those voices in my head are gonna shut up for a little while. I'm gonna calm down. Things are gonna be okay. Alcohol was my answer for everything. Whatever the problem was, alcohol solved those problems for the rest of the day. And to be honest with you, for most of the next morning, because I was so hungover or still drunk the next morning, that I was trying to figure out how to deal with life, you know, just let that wear off before life actually did come into play. So that was going along for a good while, man. And so anybody who's ever been in the Navy, if you haven't been in the military, you stand for inspection in the morning. And like I said, I'm a cook by trade. So in the morning, they look under your fingernails. And for cooks, they get real close to you, right? And this guy I was working for, his warrant officer, Brian Early was his name. And he would come by and he would get real close to me. And he would say, have you been drinking? All I smell is booze coming off you, you know? And I'd say, well, I was partying last night. You know, and I wasn't drinking. You know, I wasn't drinking this morning. But that was a lie, because I would have that tumbler of rum, and I would drink till I passed out. And I couldn't sleep through the night. And I would wake up from my blackout, and I would grab that booze and drink it a little bit more to help me get back to sleep for a little while longer, so I could get up and go to work the next morning. So anyway, he knew some people that were like us. And he said, I tell you what, man, you might want to kill yourself. You might want to wrap your car around a telephone pole, but you're not going to do it on my watch. If I can have something to do about it, I am. And I came in one morning and I just smelled, I was reeking real, real bad of just booze pouring out my pores. And he sent me over to medical for a fit for duty report. Well, little did he know that I had some friends over to medical. So when you go over for a fit for duty report, they're supposed to take you into this back room right away, and they're supposed to run a sobriety test on you, give you a breathalyzer, and they draw some blood and everything else. But my buddy over there, he said, oh man, we're swamped right now, man. Come back after lunch. And he sent me away. And I went back after lunch, and by the time I had gone back after lunch, enough of it had gone out of my system where I didn't have any real problems. I do remember a couple days later sitting in the doctor's office there on the base, and I do remember being open and honest and saying, I'm trying the best I can to drink a half a gallon of rum every day. And she said, well, we need to get you some help. And I guess she didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous because she never did mention it. But she did mention trying to look at some psychologist. And I figured if I called a couple of psychologists, or I figured if I could get in there and get into the office, they'd get this guy off my back and I can go back to drinking the way I want to be drinking. I guess for everybody's knowledge, at least it was that way in Texas, I'm sure it's the same in Virginia. When you call a psychologist and you say you got a problem with alcohol, they say, we can't help you, go to AA. Because I called about four or five of them before I finally caught on, and I called a guy and I said, I'm depressed. And they said, oh, come on in. And again, that moment of clarity when I went into his office and I said, I'm probably depressed because I'm doing the best I can to drink a half a gallon of rum every day. And he immediately said, there's nothing I can do for you. And he got up from his chair. He said, I think I got a big book here somewhere. You know, those big stack of books he's got all on the wall and everything. And he said, there's just nothing I can do for you. You need to go to AA. And you know, because you've been in AA before. You know what you need. He said, but the Navy will pay for 5 visits for you, and I'd be happy to get the money. So if you want to come back 4 more times, I'd be happy to take the money with you. And I think I did the guy a solid. I went back one more time just so he could get paid one more time. That was June 6, 2006. And I went home that night and I drank the rest of the booze that I had in my house. And I took a couple of sleeping pills so I could make it through the night. And the next day I walked into a place called the Glass House in Fort Worth, Texas. And God has a real sense of humor in my mind. I went walking in there and I'm getting ahead of myself. I went walking in there that first day, and like any good alcoholic, I was late for the noon meeting. I sat all the way in the back. The only thing I heard was someone read How It Works, and the only thing I really heard out of How It Works was cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I could just remember sitting there thinking, yeah, ain't that the truth? And before they said the prayer at the end, I ran out the door. And I had to work. The shifts I work there are 12 hours or more every day. And the next day I had to work a full 15-hour day or something. So I didn't go to a meeting the next day. And then the next day was a Friday. And I got off around 9:30, 10 o'clock. And the meeting started, I think, at noon. And the Glass House is a clubhouse in Fort Worth. And they show up probably about 10:30, 11 o'clock. And people start the coffee and they start, you know, hanging out there and doing things. So that day on Friday, when I went walking in there, this is where the sense of humor for God comes walking. Because I came walking in, and you know how it is when a newcomer comes in. You got that deer in the headlight look, and I had that, look, I guess, you know. And sure enough, there was a gentleman there, and he, you know, put out his hand, and he, hey, how you doing? And he introduced himself, and he said, the coffee's back over here. You know, come on back, get a cup of coffee. And he asked me my name, and he said, you know, ask me a couple of questions here and there. And I told him, I said, June the 6th, you know, 2 days ago, I went home and drank the rest of the booze in my house, and here I am. And he said, I got almost the same story, man. You know, I was on a cruise with my wife, and I was in the program before, and we were at this, you know, all-inclusive cruise, and I was already drinking before. He said he was already drinking before he went on the cruise, but he was out there just getting hammered every day on a cruise, not even enjoying himself anymore. And he just decided the last day of that cruise, he went home and he said, I got to go back to AA. I can't be drinking anymore. So we made a connection with that. He became my temporary sponsor. And we were going through things for a little while. You know, first 30 days or first 60 days. And he's a musician by trade, so he was kind of traveling around doing some things here and there. So he wasn't always there at the meeting. So we went through the first step, second step, and third step. When we got to the fourth step, he started explaining to me how to do the fourth step. And I was just not understanding what he was talking about, right? It wasn't coming clear for me what he was talking about. So he was out on one of his tours doing the band thing and everything, and I was over there at the Glass House. And like I said, it's a meeting hall, so they got different rooms that they have different meetings. And I was in this one newcomers meeting, and I was talking, and I was, you know, crying about, you know, how I'm not, you know, it's 2006, so cell phones are available. How I'm not getting with my sponsor, and I don't say that I'm not calling the guy. You know what I mean? But of course he's not calling me, and we're not making the right connection. And I'm just kind of bitching and moaning about it in the meeting. And when the meeting was over, this guy by the name of Bunky Stout comes walking out, and he hands me his card, and he says, "Call me tomorrow morning." And he walks away. And that was all he said. So I didn't ask anybody about it or, you know, anything else. I figured, well, I'll call him tomorrow, and then we'll see what happens. So I called him that day, and we were on the phone no longer than 5 minutes. Probably no longer than 2 minutes. He said, "How you doing? You feel like drinking?" I said, "No, I don't feel like drinking. I'm going to go to the meeting tonight." He said, "Okay, call me tomorrow." And that went along for a little while like that. We would see each other at the Glass House, too. So it wasn't like it was just calling him and not seeing him. And come to find out, Bunky had 39 years of sobriety when I met him. And he was taking meetings up to the Salvation Army there in Fort Worth. And I just kind of started hanging around with him because I liked what I was seeing from him. It was a guy who had been in the program for a while. He had something that I wanted. I saw that it had worked in his life, and he was still working the program. When I met him, he had just started coming back to AA because he had quadruple bypass surgery. So he had some serious health problems. I had less than 6 months of sobriety, and I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And he said, "Man, I just can't do that. My heart just can't handle the stress of taking somebody through the steps again." He said, "But, you know, we can still go. We can still hang out. You know, we can still go to the Salvation Army, and we, you know, we hang out here at the meetings and stuff and everything." I said, "Okay, well, you know," and a couple of days went by, and this and the other thing, going to meetings. And so finally I asked him, I said, "Well, will you help me pick a sponsor, somebody that's right?" Because when I picked the guy that I first walked into the rooms with, it was not connecting, right? There was, the connection was not there. One of the things that Bunky told me was, when you do find a new sponsor, you got to go back to your old sponsor and tell him, "Hey, I don't think things are working real well with this, and I found a new sponsor." Don't go to him until you found a new sponsor, because you don't want to be without a sponsor when you're, especially when you're first coming into the meetings. So let me tell you how to wear down a guy like that, and how to get a guy like that who's got 39, 40 years of sobriety. If you want that guy to be your sponsor, you just hang out with him all the time. you just never leave the guy's side. And that's what ended up happening. And I think there was a little bit being played on both sides of the coin, because we were going to Salvation Army, and I was hanging around, sitting next to Bunky in meetings and all this stuff, and just had quadruple bypass surgery. So I thought, well, I can drive. I got a car, you know, you shouldn't be driving and all that stuff. So like I said, it was being played on both sides of the coin, because I would say, well, you know, how about Larry? Larry might be a good guy for me to be my sponsor. And Bunky would say, "Nah, I don't think Larry's right for you, you know what I mean? Well, how about Mike? You know what I mean? Nah, I don't think Mike's the right guy for you, you know what I mean?" So there was a little bit being played back and forth like that. And it wasn't even face-to-face when we finally came down to it that he broke down and finally agreed to be my sponsor. But he said, "I got three conditions for you." He said, "Number one is you're going to go with me to the Salvation Army for those meetings that we go to on Wednesday and Friday night." And I was on shore duty there in Fort Worth, so I didn't have to go to sea. I didn't have any excuse not to go to the meetings. And they started at 8 o'clock like this meeting. This is a rarity now. You don't see many meetings that start at 8 o'clock anymore. I guess we've gotten tired in our old age. Anyway, the other one was, my ex-wife had left me at the time. and took the kids and went back to New Jersey. And so he said, we were not divorced. We had not filed papers for divorce. We were just separated. He just said, no relationships whatsoever, and especially no dating women in AA. You know, just maybe later something like that can happen, but for right now, just get that whole thing out of your mind. And then the other thing was we had to meet face to face at least 3 times a week. You know, because I can tell you anything I want to tell you over the phone. And so we, if we're not face to face, you know, I'm gonna lie to you, right? So there were 3 terms that I could agree with, and it was not a problem with going through that. So we started to go through the steps, and definitely after reading that right there, I knew I was alcoholic. I tried that controlled drinking, and I tried it for almost 10 years to manage that drinking, and it was probably the most miserable 10 years of my life, trying to manage my drinking, a head full of alcohol and a belly full of booze. Bad combination. So the part that I had a problem with in the rest of step one was I didn't think my life was unmanageable, right? I still had a house. I still had a car. I had one DUI from a long, long time ago. You know, I was providing for the wife and kids. And you know, I thought I was doing a pretty decent job managing my life, right? Until Bunky pointed out that the wife was gone to New Jersey with the kids. The Navy was about to kick me out. A job you can't get fired from, you're about to be fired from, right? So, and a couple other things that were pointed out to me. So it took a little while for me to realize that the reason my life was unmanageable was because I was managing my life, right? So once I came to that realization and we got to that point, you need a new manager. And it's not the easiest thing for me to say who's going to be the new manager in my life, right? So we had to come to that second step where you got to get a God of your understanding. But before I get too far along into what's going on with the steps and all that stuff, one of the things he pointed out to me was, if you're having trouble with step 2 or step 3 or step 4, you need to go back to the next step. So if you can't progress on to step 2, that means you're still trying to manage your life, and I need to go back to step 1 and figure out why I'm trying to manage my life and how I wrecked it and point out all the things that went on, right? One of the things that he pointed out to me that I loved was he said, this is not a race. We didn't go from Sunday school and come into the AA meetings, right? It took me many years to destroy my life and that unmanageability of it. And it's not just going to get fixed like that overnight. It's going to take time. So we're not going to do a step a day, a step a month, a step a year. We're going to do the steps at your pace. What's right for you, right? And that was something that I could really relate to, something that really hit home for me. So by this time, we got about to the third step. And there was a friend of Bunky's. His name was Brian. And Brian was just a couple years younger than me, and he had been in and out of the program and everything, and he had some other difficulties, just like, you know, I had other substances and all that stuff. And he had been to probably about 4 or 5 rehabs, and I had never been to any rehab. So when we got to step 3, and the way he explained it to me was, he said, you need to have a God of your understanding. What do you want your God to be? You can't just turn everything over to a higher power, or if you choose to call that higher power God, you can't turn it over to God if you don't know what it is, if you don't have an understanding of it. And so we're kind of going, Brian and I are on step 3 about the same time. And this is where the jealousy came in a little bit, because when we're going through it, Brian, who had been through these programs and rehab, he comes in with like 6 pages of typed stuff of what he wants his God to be. I got this little index card with 5 things on it. I'm struggling to come up with 5 things of what I want my God to be. And I carried that index card for a long time in my wallet. And unfortunately, through the years, I lost my wallet and a couple of things. So I don't have that index card anymore. But I tell you this, the number one thing on that list, on those five things, was my God's got to have a sense of humor. Because if I'm not having fun in AA, and I'm not living my life joyous and free right now, I'm going to go back out drinking. You know? So, if nothing else from those five things, that's what I remember. So, we get to the part of step four, and this is one of the things that was Brian and I kind of went our separate ways on it, because I was struggling there with three, and it took me a while to get through three. And then one of the things Monkey pointed out for step four, he said, you want to take a month or two looking for the perfect pen? Take a month or two looking for the perfect pen. If you want to take another month or two looking for the perfect notebook, take a month or two looking for the perfect pen. Take your time. Whatever fits you, then do that. But don't procrastinate. Make sure you're working on it. Be doing something to progress you forward on that. Well, I'm in the Navy, so I get pens for free, so that's no big deal. And I just bought one of those dollar store composition books. I had already journaled a little bit in my life, so I didn't have a problem with looking for the perfect notebook for me. And I've been blessed, except for a few of the blackout times when I was drunk, of having that memory of that first case of Genesee Cream Ale and those first drinks that we ended up having. So what he explained to me was, you're going to go back to your first memory of when you started drinking, and you're going to write a narrative of your life up until the day that you walked into the glass house. You know, and we'll take it off from there. And write a narrative of your life, and I was 39 years old at the time, so, you know, it was quite a few years there that I, and a lot of things. And all that time that I was sober the first time, and all those years that I tried to stay sober, white knuckle on it through, you know, all that stuff had to be written down. Since then, I've heard a few things, and this by no means is there, I think, is there no way of just doing the four step just one way. I know the book has it a certain way, and that's what my temporary sponsor, we tried to go through the book, and I just couldn't comprehend it. But when Bunky did it and we did the narrative, I could comprehend that. And then there's been a couple of guys that I was sponsoring where they had trouble remembering their last year, or they had trouble remembering last month. So we wrote the narrative backwards, you know, from when they can remember what it was last month. And it seemed to help, because as they got that stuff out of their head, it opened up for something else for them to remember something else, you know. So the hardest part about doing a fifth step with a guy who's got 40 years of sobriety is keeping him awake. We would sit down. So when we went to do the fifth step, I sat down, and then I had my book with me and everything. And Bucky told me to get a pen, because I'm going to tell you to make some notes here, and you'll flip to the back of your book and you'll write some stuff in there. And he got a legal pad out, and he asked me if it was okay for him to take some notes. So I didn't have a problem with that. And that's, he explained it to me, and this is the way he explained it to me. When you're doing your fifth step, this is where you're going to find your character defects that are your sixth step. So I hear a lot of people saying it took them an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, 15 hours to do a fifth step. It took me about 3 months to do a fifth step. And it wasn't because I had so much stuff to share, but a guy who's got 40 years of sobriety, he kept falling asleep. And he would wake up and say, are you hungry? Let's go get something to eat. So we would stop doing the fifth step, and we would go get something to eat. Looking back on it now, one of the things about that was it gave me time to go through those things, you know, that I was sharing with him. And things that I wrote down and things that he had me write down, or things that he wrote down. And like I said, that took you to the sixth step, took me there to the sixth step, where it was identifying your character defects. Because if you don't identify your character defects, how are you going to ask God to take them away and change it, right? When it came to the seventh step, and I got there, I was, by this time, Bunky was pushing me out to go talk to other people. Because this is one of the things that I truly believe. Nobody in AA, not one person, has all the answers. There's no sponsor guru, or there's no, you got to find your answers from other people. There's not just one person who's going to have everything for you. And when I came to the seventh step, I was splitting hairs between being humiliated and being humble. Because there was plenty of times where I had humiliated my kids, being drunk and naked in front of their friends and slurring my words all over the place and acting like an idiot, right? And being humble to a higher power who was going to manage my life. And I finally talked it over with Bunky for a long time, and even there I wasn't really comprehending what he was trying to explain to me, until finally I was in the glass house one day, and a guy in the kitchen said, "Stop splitting hairs, man. Either God's everything or he's nothing. Right? Either he's going to keep you sober, and he's going to keep you sober today, or you're going to go back out and doing a deal. And that's it. Don't make it complicated." So that was enough for me. That was humbling to get to that point. The eighth step was just like we hear a lot of people saying, it was the same thing for me, where we just, as we were going along and I was reading my fifth step out, we were pulling names out, and I was writing names down in the back. And there was one guy that I swore I owed this person an amends. And when it came time to discuss making these amends in the eighth step and who it was, I brought this guy's name up, and we had to go back into my fourth step, and I read out what it was and everything. And one of the things Bunky pointed out to me, said, "I don't know. I'm not. You should pray about it, and let's talk to some other alcoholics. But I mean, I can see where you're wrong in that, but I'm not so sure you owe an amends to this guy." You know. So I think that's the importance of sponsorship and doing those things. For the ninth step and going and making those amends, the first thing he told me was, never go make an amends without talking to your sponsor first. If at all possible, never go make an amends by yourself. Take your sponsor with you or someone else you know. They don't have to be sitting right there next to you the whole time, but they should be within the proximity of where you're at, you know, to go just for that support, I guess is what it was. The two amends I share are my youngest daughter and my mother. My youngest daughter, I went to her and I said, let me back up. He also said, when you go to make amends, don't say you're sorry, because they already know how sorry you are. All right. So when I went to my daughter and I said, I need to make an amends for the things that I put you through, all the embarrassment, with your friends and all that stuff. And my daughter just kind of laughed and looked at me and said, "Dad, just don't do dumb things anymore." And that really just kind of wore me up. So I shared there about drinking and getting sober, and that first time I got sober, when I went to make amends to my mother, and she said, "I want you to promise me you'll never drink again." And I said, "I promise, I'll never drink again." And I went out and I got drunk again. So this time around, when I went to her and I said, "I need to make amends for all the wrongs that I've done you," and I've done a lot of wrong to my mother. And she said, "I want you to promise me you'll never drink again." And I said, "I can't make that promise. I did that once already and it didn't work. And I can't make that promise to you." And she said, "Then I can't forgive you." And at the time, my mother was in Kissimmee, Florida, and I was in Jacksonville, Florida. And I was calling her twice a week already before I went to make the amends to her. And I was going down from Jacksonville down to Kissimmee, driving down once or twice a month and seeing her and everything. And we got to that sticking point, and that was it. We just kind of glazed over that. She can't forgive me and I can't make that promise. We moved on with our lives. We still had a great relationship. Yeah. She has since moved back up to New Jersey, and just this past June she celebrated her 90th birthday. And my wife and I were just up there to see her a month ago, and her face just lit up when I came walking into the room. It's just really something. So I was in the beginning, I was laying there in Fort Worth, and I was trying to get a few hours of sleep in the first 6 months or whatever, and I would just chant the Serenity Prayer, watching the ceiling fan spin around and hoping I'd get a few hours of sleep. And when I told Bunky about this, he said, "I want you to stop chanting the Serenity Prayer and I want you to start saying the 11th step prayer. Because if you ask for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out, then that'll get you through the day." And so I started doing that 11th step prayer right then and there. That warrant officer that spurred me into getting into AA, It had to be more than 6 months sober because I was working with Bunky at the time. Him and I clashed heads at work, and he's my boss, right? He's been a cook a lot longer than I have. He cooked at the White House. He has a prestigious career, right? And here's this guy who doesn't even have a year sober who's yelling and screaming at him, telling him he's doing his job wrong. And I was so upset, and I called Bunky on the phone and I said, hey, you know, this is what happened. And he said, as soon as you hang up, walk back in there and go make an amends to that man immediately, because you were wrong. And talk about a humbling experience. You know, I had to walk in there and I had to go pull that guy to the side and I had to tell him that I was wrong and he's right, because this is his job, right? He's the boss and I should be listening to him. And I'd like to stand here and tell you in the past 10 years that that's never happened again, but it has. My temper gets the best of me sometimes, and sometimes I fly off the handle. What has happened in the past 10 years is now when I get angry and now when I get upset, I pause and I try to think. Sometimes I'll say the Serenity Prayer, sometimes I'll say the 11th Step Prayer, but whatever it is that I'm saying in my head, those other words that I want to be vomiting out my mouth are not coming out. So I hold it in. And then the 12th step was, I started that in the very beginning. Right? We started going up there to the Salvation Army and coming here to speak is one of those things. But I'll share a quick story about Salvation Army. When I was there in Fort Worth, we were going to those two meetings a week. I bought a house in Jacksonville, Florida. After I bought the house, I'm looking for where meetings are. There's a meeting, I find the Salvation Army. It's less than a half a mile from the house that I bought. I can walk over to the Salvation Army. And I go, wow, man, this is God working in my life right here, right? When I get orders up here to Virginia, I was stationed over in Virginia Beach. We rented a condo directly behind the adult rehab center on Virginia Beach Boulevard. And I just thought, this is just too eerie to be any kind of coincidence, you know. And they had meetings over there on Thursday night, a speaker meeting. And yeah, sure, I started going over there to those meetings at the Salvation Army. And you just constantly just giving it back. I'm going to end with just this. Let me just really quick. So since then, and all that stuff is going on, I got divorced, and my kids living at my house in Jacksonville, Florida. And when I got divorced, I didn't think that I would ever, I guess everybody kind of goes through that. You know, you never want to be in a relationship again. Well, God had other plans, and he put a woman in my life now who is far beyond what I deserve. So one of the things when I like to say I'm from the class of 2006, you know, and there were some people, a lot of people who were getting sober at the time when we were there in Fort Worth, and they were making these gratitude lists. And when I told Bunky about those guys making gratitude lists, he said, you can make a list if you want to. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Don't tell me about it. I don't know what want to know what's on your list or anything else. So a couple months went by and I told him, you know, I never did make that list. And he said, good. Because you cut yourself short on what God has planned for you. All right, I'm getting choked up thinking about things. I'll finish with this. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. I was. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. I have. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Absolutely. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. Let's just pause here really quick, because when I first got sober, I was over 20 grand in debt, and I'm not in debt anymore today. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. That happens every day for me. Thanks.